Next case this morning, United States v. Davis, number 245018. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Federal Public Defender Amy Senya on behalf of the appellant, Cody Davis. May it please the court. This case asks the court to recognize the common sense principle that a 20-year-old convicted of consuming alcohol underage has committed an offense similar to the quintessential juvenile status offense of consuming alcohol underage. The crux of a juvenile status offense is that it criminalizes bland conduct only because of the offender's age that would be entirely lawful for adults. Here, Mr. Davis was convicted for drinking a couple of beers in a private home with a few friends when he was just a few months shy of 21. Because this bland conduct would have been entirely legal in only 5 months' time, common sense dictates that his offense is sufficiently similar to a juvenile status offense and should have received no criminal history points under the guidelines. This court should reverse. The guidelines require a common sense approach. 4A1.2C2 excludes juvenile status offenses and offenses similar to them. And then the commentary directs courts to use a common sense approach to make that determination. And the commentary provides a list of potentially helpful factors, though it isn't a mechanical checklist, and allows flexibility for the court to look at some factors that might be more helpful than others in any given case. And here, using that common sense approach, his offense is similar to a juvenile status offense. I think the first step, that's the easiest way to resolve this case, is to determine whether underage drinking generally is a juvenile status offense if the offender is under the age of 18. The government doesn't seem to dispute this, and we cited many cases saying that. And so if everyone's on board with that, that makes this a very easy case because then
well, can you focus on the first two factors, because that seems to be what the primary dispute is about.
Sure. And so the punishment factors are really most helpful when we're comparing two different offenses. So if a defendant has a conviction for animal abuse and says, this is similar to a fish and game violation, we don't really have a gut sense of how similar those crimes are. So that's when we look to the statutory maximum punishments to see if they are punished similarly. That's a good way to assess seriousness. But here, we're talking about the exact same offense. We know that it's a juvenile status offense if the offender is under 18, and so then we don't need to look to the statutory maximum to determine the relative seriousness. It's just not that helpful.
Let me clarify. Are you suggesting that these factors that the guideline commentary sets out aren't necessarily...
Excuse me, Judge Murray.
Yeah.
Are you speaking to your microphone, please?
Sure. I'm sorry, Judge Kelly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just realized. Sorry. I'm asking if your position is that you don't really even need to go through all these factors in some cases, such as the present case, because the punishment isn't really relevant because they're just that similar, essentially. And do you have any support for that?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And so I suppose my support would be some of the cases cited in the briefing, Bravo, Ward. Those cases talk about how, you know, you can look at punishment, it's sometimes relevant, but there might be better gauges of comparative seriousness.
There's no case that says, that I'm aware of, though, that you can basically skip a couple of those factors.
I think the Griffin case...
Because if the punishment is significantly different, isn't that some indication that perhaps there is a difference, even though on their face they appear to be extremely similar?
I think it could be in theory, but it's not here when you know that the underlying conduct is exactly the same. It's the same elements. It's the same offense. And then you also know what the actual conduct was in the case. And so it might be a different situation where we don't actually know what the underlying facts are, but here we do. And we know that they are exactly what you would expect of a juvenile status offense. He's just doing something that's illegal solely because of his age. And so the Ward case in the Seventh Circuit is really helpful on this because the crime there was underage possession of a firearm. And the court says that can be a juvenile status offense. It cannot be. It depends on the underlying facts. And so if it was criminalized, if he was convicted because he was 17 and had a firearm, then that is the quintessential juvenile status offense. But if you look at the underlying facts and actually he used the firearm in committing a felony, that would be a felony for an adult, then it's not really a juvenile status offense at that point.
What was the punishment in that case?
The court didn't even talk about it. Apparently the court didn't think that punishment was probative of assessing similarity.
Well, the guidelines certainly do, though. And it seems like there's this conduct on the one hand and punishment on the other hand. And the criminal history guideline in general focuses on prior sentences of imprisonment. And that's what it looks at, is the prior sentence, not the underlying conduct. And these factors refer to comparison of punishments, perceived series of the offenses indicated by the level of punishment. And we had punishment here. That it seems that factor favors the government. You point out that, well, Illinois is an outlier, and maybe it is, but wouldn't that support an argument, or wouldn't that more comfortably support an argument for a variance and not an argument about criminal history points?
I don't think so, because I think the very fact that the guidelines typically look at level of punishment, that's the rule throughout this whole chapter, except for this one place.
Well, no, it says punishment. The list of factors talks about punishments, and the criminal history provision is all about punishment. So, I mean, I understand your point that you think conduct not only should be relevant, but maybe should even drive the whole issue. But I'm having a hard time squaring that with the guideline and even the factors.
So I think the factor that's, you know, talks to the second factor, it says the perceived seriousness of the offense as indicated by punishment. So it's not looking at punishment in a vacuum. It's looking at punishment to try to determine seriousness. And that might be a helpful way to determine that here. But if we look at the cases, Bravo, Griffin, Ward, and Landa, they all talk about how you can look at punishment, that's fine, but there's other things that you have to look at too. And that's the core conduct of the offense. What, you know, whether they're conceptually the same crime or similar crimes, what the actual conduct was, whether the offense had this bland quality that makes it similar to the other offenses listed, whether it shows, you know, a likelihood of committing future conduct, those helpfully track the other factors. So
is there a standard of review abuse of discretion?
No, it's de novo. The parties agree on that.
What if we think it's abuse of discretion? What happens to your argument?
So I think the Abeta case is what says it's de novo, but if you think that it's abuse of discretion, I don't think that changes anything.
Well, I just think when you have a five-factor test that involves weighing different factors, why wouldn't we at least show some deference to the district court on something like that?
Because the district court didn't weigh the factors. The district court didn't understand the test. The district
court. Oh, well, that's a different matter. I mean, if the court simply applied the wrong approach, is that the de novo standard? That would be de novo. But if the court actually went through and applied these factors, then would it be abuse of discretion?
I don't think so. I think it's still de novo.
Do you have any authority on that? I know you've agreed, but
I think the Griffin case says that the court just goes through the factors again de novo. The case that I said in the briefs was Abeta. But I think, you know, here if the court didn't weigh the factors, there's nothing to defer to.
I understand your argument. I don't want to belabor the point.
Counsel, if we agreed with you, wouldn't remand be futile? Because the district court varied upward regardless of the guideline sentence.
So I think if your honor is...
In other words, it didn't make any difference to him. I thought in reading the record here that he was confused on what was being argued in the first place. And the similitude never really got through. He was looking to see if it was the same as. And I think that's a different approach. A similitude has got to mean something. But when he varies upward, then it was within the statutory maximum regardless. And why wouldn't this be harmless?
So it's the government's burden to show harmlessness. They haven't invoked it here. And it's not harmless because it's well established in this court that if there is an error that affects the guideline range, then we can't say that it's harmless because the guideline range is the anchor for the court. So even if the court ends up varying upward, the fact that the guideline range should have been lower is what would have anchored the court in the first place. And I don't have the exact case offhand because we didn't talk about harmlessness in the briefs, but I'm happy to submit the 28J. That's well established. I think there's a Supreme Court case that says it as well.
Since the district court did fail to conduct this inquiry, which to me is at least partly factual, based on 4 and 5, maybe. Some of the factors are factual. Wouldn't the answer be, if we agreed with you, obviously, that it should have been conducted, to remand it yet again, and I think this would be the third time, maybe, for the court to conduct the inquiry it should have conducted in the first place, let it decide whether the result of that inquiry would impact the sentence?
I think you could, but I don't think that you need to or you should for just judicial economy. It's already before the court, and the lodestar is common sense. So at the end of the day, we have these factors, but the court has said, really, the factors are, it's not a mechanical checklist. The court says that in Griffin. And really, they're just supposed to help guide the court's, you know, treatment of common sense. But here, when we know they're the exact same crime, the core is exactly the same, we don't have to get into all of these factors. We can just go with our common sense understanding of these offenses. And so for that reason, I think the court wouldn't need to remand. I'll reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Thank you.
Valeria Lester for the United States, and may it please the court. I want to begin my time today by correcting an error that's in the government's brief. On page 11 of the government's brief, the government references an Illinois compiled statute that's found at chapter 705, article 5, part 170. That specific statute references the right of juveniles to be represented by counsel in juvenile court proceedings. That is the incorrect statute, and it transposes the first two numbers of the part, the 1 and the 7. The correct statute is the same chapter, Article 5, Part 710, which does address the types of punishments available in juvenile court proceedings. With my apologies, I'd like to address a few of Mr. Davis's arguments presented here today.
What does similar to mean? If it doesn't mean similar to, what is similar to?
Your Honor, similar to has been defined in the guideline provisions and commentary note 12A with the common sense approach. The idea being
that... What does that mean? What is a common sense approach? It's similar to. It's either similar or it's not, okay? Do you agree with that?
Yes, using the common sense multi-factor approach, one could arrive at whether or not the listed and unlisted offenses were similar.
Okay.
That common sense approach, now, yes, Your Honor.
Now, using the common sense approach, if a kid is 14 and drinks, how much time does he get?
I don't know the answer.
He doesn't get any time. He doesn't get any time, okay? He's a juvenile. So if another juvenile, but he's a 19-year-old juvenile, does the same thing, and still an adult would not be guilty of either of those, why isn't that similar to using the common sense approach?
Specifically in Illinois, Your Honor, the state of Illinois...
I don't care about Illinois. I'm talking about the crime itself, for the history. So isn't this similar to a juvenile offense?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Would not be, you disagree. Why?
I disagree because, and Mr. Davis is asking this court to apply a categorical approach to those offenses. And that's not the goal of this petition.
He's asking for a common sense approach.
Yes, Your Honor, we're asking for a common sense approach. However, to say that categorically unlawful consumption by someone under the age of 18 is in fact a juvenile status offense does not give credence to what is a juvenile status offense. And because that does not...
What is a juvenile status offense?
This court has used the juvenile status offense adopted in Archuleta, which includes the fact that an offense must occur by someone who's under the age of 18. It must include conduct that would be legal but for the defendant's age, and it must be non-serious in nature. The non-serious in nature part is the piece that's critical here. Mr. Davis wants you to focus on the first two factors, which is age specific only. However, when you focus on that third factor, the seriousness can depend from can vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. By creating a categorical approach but a categorical finding that unlawful consumption is a juvenile status offense is unfair.
Serious in nature has much to do with the circumstances of the crime just as much as it does the punishment. And in this case, Illinois just categorically punishes all adult crimes with imprisonment of up to 1 year. I mean, this is not some reasoned determination by the Illinois legislature that underage drinking by anybody under the age of 21 is a very serious offense. There's nothing like that here. And the circumstances of this particular crime certainly don't under any common sense definition, come within a serious offense. He's at a residence and there's underage drinking going on.
I think that a bit misrepresents what happened, respectfully, Your Honor.
Well, do you see my point about the word serious? It's not just about punishment.
Absolutely. And seriousness does also contemplate the underlying conduct. And that is clear across the cases as it references the third prong of a juvenile status offense, as well as the fourth and fifth factors of the multi-factor common sense approach, that courts can consider the underlying conduct.
Well, speaking of the multi-factor common sense approach, it's interesting to me, and I'm with Judge Kelly about what does common sense mean if it doesn't mean that in this case these two offenses are essentially similar. I mean, they're essentially identical. And the comment doesn't say the common sense approach requires you to take all of these factors into account and you've got to give particular consideration to any one of them. It says the court should use a common sense approach. That includes consideration of relevant factors, such as, and then it lists these factors. I don't even think you have to look at these factors, according to the comment. It's what's relevant in that particular case, and what would a common sense approach be in this case? And wouldn't it be to say, underage drinking isn't a whole lot different between the, 18 and under and 21 and under. And in fact, perhaps it's even more significant for someone 18 and under than 21 and under.
I think that it's more dangerous for someone under 18 and under to be drinking. However, that does not make them more culpable than someone who is over 18. An individual who is 18 to 20 years old who is drinking is more culpable than their juvenile counterpart. And that's the critical distinction here. While you do not have to consider, and no court's required to consider, the common sense multi-factor approach, they are actually factors that help establish whether or not the offense is serious. Well, and
apart,
punishment.
But apart from, I understand your argument about culpable being tied to age, but just looking again at conduct, whether it's a 17-year-old, no punishment, or at least no jail. 21-year-old, no punishment, no jail. 18 to 20, punishment, jail. But same conduct across the board. Doesn't that make it all similar?
I disagree, Your Honor, because there are factors taken into place by individual state legislatures. Specifically, they did this in Illinois, where they believed that juveniles were less culpable and therefore...
Well, I wasn't, again, I was limiting my question only to the conduct part. I know that if you move to other factors, you're going to be able to make some arguments, but I'm just on the seriousness of the, just the conduct, what happened. Is there really any material difference, 17-year-old, 19-year-old, 21-year-old, doing the exact same thing?
I acknowledge that they're the exact same conduct. However, the age does play a factor into culpability. I disagree with Mr. Davis that individuals 18 to 20 are somehow less culpable than their juvenile counterparts. In this specific case, the law enforcement were called to an apartment building based on an underage drinking party. Now, they don't say it in the reports, but that suggests that there was some type of a disturbance that occurred at this apartment. That's not the bland house get-together described by Mr. Davis. Moreover, that one of the leaseholders...
Well, you're totally guessing at that, aren't you? The record doesn't support that.
Your Honor, the record does reflect the fact that law enforcement were called based on an anonymous tip that there was an underage drinking party at an apartment complex.
Right. And if the kid had been 15, they would have said, go on home and don't do it again. That what's similar? And what's common sense mean?
Well, common sense in this case, and based on Mr. Davis's conduct, would mean that Mr. Davis, at the time that he was in that apartment, the apartment holder acknowledged that there were underage children in the apartment prior to law enforcement arriving. Mr. Davis was a convicted sex offender and required to register. Moreover,
well, we're not talking about this. We're talking about the history. We're going into the history that resulted in his ultimate sentence. And if we look at just what he did, he's in jail, he deserves to be in jail. But calculating the right, coming up with the right calculation is the issue.
And I agree, Your Honor. And the court is not required to take any of these factors. No factor is dispositive. Obviously, the government believes that the punishment Mr. Davis received in this case and the range of punishment contemplated by the state of Illinois are the most important factors.
Well, did it decide that? I mean, I'm back to the point that was raised earlier about whether the court even really said why the offense was not similar to a juvenile status offense. I mean, we really don't have much to go by in terms of where the district court came out on this. You're taking us through all these factors, but did the court even go through that analysis?
The court didn't go through the full analysis. The court did, however, go through one of the factors. That's factor three of the common sense approach, which is comparing the elements of the offense. The court did engage in an analysis of whether or not that was a juvenile status offense. Now, the court did not technically compare that with or engage in a similarity analysis.
Which means it didn't go through the proper analysis. I mean, that's just clear here. I have another question. If this if this individual had been 5 months older and he had drank huge amounts of whatever, and he's out in public and he's publicly intoxicated and he'd been arrested for public intoxication and convicted, that wouldn't count, would it?
That would be excluded.
It would be excluded.
Yes, Your Honor.
And under what common sense approach does that make any sense to you?
I am hesitant to compare Mr. Davis.
Well, you have to, because we're talking about common sense here.
Correct. But Mr. Davis was not publicly intoxicated in this case.
Right. But you were talking about how egregious a conduct it was to be at this party and underage drinking. And to me, public intoxication is included in the list of prior convictions that are never counted. Never counted. So he could have been any age above the age of 18, and it wouldn't matter. That public intoxication, no matter how intoxicated he was, would not have counted.
That would be correct.
But it's going to count. This is going to count because he was underage drinking in a residence, and the argument is that's not similar to underage drinking by an 18-year-old or someone under the age of 18. It's kind of nonsensical, frankly.
And Mr. Davis was not, in fact, drinking in public, so I disagree that public intoxication would be the appropriate comparison there.
I'm saying it doesn't make sense that a crime like public intoxication is included on the list if a crime like underage drinking is not. You know, it's similar in the sense that it's even more similar to a crime that is included, juvenile status offenses like underage drinking. So I'm struggling to see why this isn't similar using a common sense approach.
A crime that is also included in 4A1.2C1 is disturbance of the peace. And mm-hmm. if someone was in their private home drinking and engaging in a party, and that party disturbed the other residents, then that would be disturbance of the peace. And Mr. Davis's conviction would qualify under that. He received a 60-day sentence, 2 years of conditional discharge, and a fine. That would more than qualify for inclusion under C1 based on disturbance of the peace. And disturbance of the peace would be a better representation than public intoxication in this case, because Mr. Davis was, in fact, in a private residence and was not publicly intoxicated.
So where are you, if this court finds error, where are you on harmless error?
Your Honor, we did not raise harmless error mainly because, and I agree with Mr. Davis in this point, if the guidelines were miscalculated, they do in fact need to be calculated. And I appreciate Judge Kelly's comment earlier about Judge Heil, the district court, upward varying in this case. However, he did upward vary a set number of levels from the established guideline range. Your Honor, I see I am out of time. May I finish my answer?
Please do.
He varied upward from the established guideline range, and therefore, if the guidelines were not correctly calculated, that would need to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I think we have some rebuttal time.
Unless there are questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you. The case will be submitted. This time, both counselors are excused. And